Hello and welcome to another special episode of the Offside Musings podcast. My name is Oke Ndibe. It's my delight to welcome you on behalf of my co-host, Emeka Onyawa. In today's podcast, we're just going to look at a bunch of issues in Nigeria. We're going to look at controversies in the country around budget padding. We're going to look at rising violence. We're going to look at the rising misery that we're witnessing anecdotally within the country. And we're going to share a few personal stories to illustrate that. And we're going to speak also to the particular tone-deaf politics, tone-deaf activities of the man who is the president of the Nigerian Senate, Godswill Akpabio. So it's our delight again to welcome you as you join us today. So, Emeka, you and I were talking, I think it was last night, and we were sharing stories of death and how it's become omnipresent. Everywhere you look, people are dropping. And it's not just one person dying. It's in my case, for example, that there is a distant cousin, a second cousin of mine, who lost her father-in-law. And then within a few days, her own husband, who was expected to bury his father, also died. And you told me an even more dramatic story of people who are related to you, at least people that you know, and the sudden death, sort of a spiral of death around them. So I'll let you tell that story, and we can talk about what we speculate to be happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, the amount of people. I personally, you know, I'm still dealing with mine right now, but as I was dealing with that, I was talking with my cousin, and he was telling me his, who it's like his sister-in-law passed, and then they told the husband passed a couple of days later, and then the mother of the husband was around, and then the mother passes as well. And then they had to tell the father, the woman's husband, as the father of her father-in-law. And they went and told him while he was sitting down at home. And right there and then, inside the chair, they got the man who passed as well. So you had four people that have passed in the space of, you know, and you know, my cousin and I were dealing with death in our own family as well. And then, well, you know, he's dealing with that as well. So it's like, it's, yeah, man, it's hard to see, though. It's crazy. It's something that it's hard to see. It's hard to get through. It's hard to even get day by day, man. But for me, it's just like just getting day by day. That's what's going on. Okay, all right, cool. What's going on this hour? Just try to keep busy. You know, thankfully, I'm super busy anyway. But you know, yeah.
It helps to be busy, and I was sort of joking to you yesterday, and I said that you have to take care of yourself because we need you around when we see these sequence of deaths happening so close, in close proximity. It becomes worrying. And sort of my theory, again, there is no science to it, but my theory is that in Igbo land, for example, more so than in many other parts of Nigeria, funerals are a very expensive thing. So you have a situation where a growing number of people can't find one meaningful meal to eat a day, and suddenly they are confronted with the death of a loved one. They know they are going to be responsible for the funeral rites. They know they are going to be expected to provide a lot of food for people, a lot of alcohol, all kinds of entertainment for people, give money to churches or to traditional institutions for the funeral. And I think that this, in a situation where poverty is already crushing so many people to the ground, perhaps precipitates, obviously, when you hear the loss of a loved one, there is a certain amount of emotional toil that it takes, right? So when you have that shock to your system, and it's compounded by the fact that you simply have no money, no resources to do what our people call a befitting burial, which is a very fairly opulent affair, depending on the circumstances of the bereaved, that this can quickly precipitate death. And I think that that's part of what's going on here, because I've never seen it happen like this, where there are multiple, it's happened occasionally, don't get me wrong, but the frequency with which it's happening, the regularity with which it's happening, it's just unbelievable.
Yeah, I was talking to my family members. I was saying it feels way more than usual. But then again, I don't know how to define usual, really. It could be that it hits you around. I remember when my father died 19 years ago. I was like 21 at that time, 2021. And when he died, 2 months later, my grandmother passed, and my mom is her only child. So in that bubble for me, it felt like, and prior to that, my uncle had passed, even though his was kind of, it's a lot more complicated and complex as things have happened, but his was maybe a little bit less distant, but it just felt like everywhere around me was the death. So it could be that in my personal perspective. I said we're dealing with our own personal death, and then my cousin is dealing with all that on one side, and it feels like even when I open WhatsApp chat groups in Nigeria, it feels like somebody's about to pass or somebody has passed or something like that, and it's typically in Nigeria. So I don't know, maybe it's normal, maybe it is, and it's all different and diverse. It's not something that you'd say. Some people might want to say, well, maybe it's health or COVID, or I don't know, it's just very diverse. A lot of these people they don't fall under any category. You can't say that they are A, B, or C. It's a complex thing. It's just very complex as a thing. So if it does feel like, I guess that's my comfort human being right now. While I'm trying to go through my understanding hourly, I guess. But it does feel like, yes, the economic situation is hitting. And, like you were saying yesterday, that some people just calculate. If I remember when you said that, then I remember a story. I remember how, when my father died, there's a different feel when people you relate with die. Some people might shut it out. I had people who are my relations who didn't want to even pick up their phone calls until tomorrow. I think some of them still blame me for telling them that my father had passed, which they were supposed to know quite early. So, it's different when you deal with it, just like what we're dealing with now. My father's sibling just passed, and it's quite close to us, and my aunt and all that. So it's different when he hits you. And then when he hits you and you have a responsibility to play, yes, it's also an added pressure on that person. So I was going to go to remembering a story that people told me when there was a guy who was gambling, playing something called draft back 19 years ago. So when my father died, I was in a different situation. Like I was young. I had, I think even in my room that day, I had probably about $6,000-$7,000 cash. in my room that day, and there was money in some other accounts and stuff like that. But there was this guy who was playing drafts, and there was a lot of money on the line in this draft that he was playing at this point in time. And they told him his father died, and he didn't even blink. Whoa. He didn't blink. He kept on playing and playing and playing.
Money.
And then once he won, he jumped up and shouted, "Yay!" And then he started the emotions finally took over. Whoa. Yeah, like that money on the line was something substantial. I would estimate it at this point. It was probably early 2000s. So he'd estimate somewhere around, I think, $2,000, somewhere around that, some at that time. Plus or minus, you can adjust for inflation right now, what $2,000 would have been in the late 90s and early 2000s. So you can adjust for inflation and all that. So anyway.
Yeah, so you were talking about all that money that was, that was a stake, and so this guy was super focused on the winning, and then once he won, I guess it struck him that, whoa, my father had died, and he, the emotional impact, and then registers.
Yeah, I would say that he put away the feelings, right? He put away his father died. He realized it. He just, I still have people till today who act like my father didn't die. Right? It's easy to sit down in your mind and just be like, all right, cool. I'm going to put that away and all that. So he put that away, which was, and then when he was ready, he gets that. And he just let the emotions in finally. Which is not a healthy thing, but given the circumstances, which one would be unhealthier, to be broke and having to bury your father, or, stick away with the emotions and this thing. So it just goes to buttress your point that the reality is when you have a death in the family, like the one we have now, is a little bit tempered because she's a nun. But when you have a death in the family, you have a responsibility. You have a financial responsibility to get things done. And unfortunately, we don't live in a climate where people plan for those things. Unfortunately, these things don't happen in a climate where people plan for those things. We live in a climate where you there's a good chance you have people who have planned their own burial down to the last details. And
you mean in America,
yes, in the world. So
pay for their grave sites, they decide what kind of games, music they want to play, what kind of ceremony they want to do. They plan even where people should go for a repast after they're committed to earth, so there's that whole we still have this mysterious take on death. We still see death as something extremely frightening, in our society. So people, it's like the whole idea. I was speaking to a friend of mine some years ago, and I told a friend that every year, many Americans, if not most, at least those who have health insurance, you are required to go for a physical checkup where the doctor checks all kinds of vitals to see if there are warning signs of potential strokes, heart attacks, diabetes in your future, and so that they become proactive in sort of controlling those elements. And I said to this friend that it would be a good idea to start such a thing in Nigeria, and he just laughed. And he said to me, why would he go to a doctor when he wasn't sick? So I was trying to explain to him that by the time you are sick, in a lot of ways, depending on the sickness, it's too late for you. If you have a stroke and you go to a doctor, it's too late. It would be better to know that you have a predisposition to suffering a stroke or a heart attack so that there can be some kind of remediation of that condition, right? Mm-hmm. But the whole idea for a lot of Nigerians of going to the doctor when you are not ill, to say to the doctor, look at me and see if there is anything that might go wrong in the future, seems to Nigerians, to some people at any rate, as a way of mystically inviting illness to come to you, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's the same way we sort of feel if we plan for our dying by writing our will, by, you know, living well, even saying if I'm in an accident, I'm in this condition, please don't resuscitate me, use my organs, donate my organs that are good to people and so on. A lot of our people can't get into all of that. Even the idea of having life insurance, right? So that typically when people die, even in America, amongst our people who have come to America, who are in Europe and so on, when they die, there's an emergency convocation of what's called the Committee of Friends. And that committee begins to tax, you know, them, you know, members of their number, as well as the larger community, typically in what they call a wake, where people come to donate funds to enable the bereaved family to convey the remains of the deceased to Nigeria for burial. And yet, these things can be easily taken care of if one took out an insurance, so that when you die, your survivors have, you know, some change that they get from the insurance companies that can quite easily take care of your funeral. But of course, a lot of our people don't want to deal with the fact that, you know, the only way we live this life is dead. You know, nobody lives alive, you know. And so, we're now.
I mean, it's good to have a long life. Don't get me wrong, it's great. I think, like on my father's side, for at least my father's siblings, none of them was, well, they were, I mean, all of them died in their 70s, between 71 to 75. On their side. So some people will say that's a long life. But
life expectancy in Nigeria, that's not bad at all. You know, the life expectancy in Nigeria is in the low 50s, right?
Yeah.
And of course, yeah, the people who have a high standard of living, you'd expect that they'll do better.
Yeah. And the other side is different. They live a lot longer. But at the end of the day, it's hard for people to, understandably, you know, they don't look up to life insurance as anything but they should, when they should, because life insurance is a good financial tool, actually, more than any other thing. But they don't look at those things. They don't look at the planning of it, really, which a lot of times when you're, especially if you have to be buried in the village, thankfully, you know, in some cases you don't have to be, but if you have to be buried in the village, there is a lot of intrigues and politics and things that have to happen. But yeah, it's something that people don't look at, don't set up for. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily obviously think it's the best, I think. And then you have standards, like you said, people want to meet or people want to surpass. And I have an uncle that when his father died, he sold his house. And they call him, his nickname, or if you're Roman, is Akogamin. Olinaya. That he buried his father, that he, the man that buried his father, how do you say it again, man? Anyway, it's, my head is not clicking well. Sorry. There's a way we say it in our style. I'm trying to say it how we say it.
Buried his father in a grand way.
Olinaya. I like it. It's like that hard. This when like when they say, oh, somebody buried their father, that guy buried his father. Yeah, that's the standard.
That's performance, yeah. And
that's the standard.
A lot of ways our funerals have become, over the years, it's become performative.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to turn a funeral into a grand spectacle. And the more obscene, the more opulent, the better, you know. So it's like, I remember, and it's so strange, because then we leave the essential elements for, and we pursue things that are inconsequential. I remember years ago, a very wealthy Nigerian buried his father. And so the burial was featured in a Soft Cell magazine, and they interviewed this guy, and he was boasting that when his father lay in state, he put a designer suit made by some opaque, to me, Italian designer, you know, for the father to lie in state. The next day, before they committed the father to earth, he then changed his father's get up to another designer, and he was announcing the thousands of dollars that these things cost. And then at the end, the interviewer says to him, "So how do you feel about the death of your father?" He said, "I don't want to talk, because if I talk, I might start crying." Now, to cry for a loss is natural, right? But he doesn't want to do what's natural and organic, to mourning. But he was doing something that is so artificial and so outlandish, which is to boast about putting designer clothes on a man who would not know whether you put a rag on him or you put the most prized regalia on him, right? So he's focusing on all these strange things. But, you know, today we have a short conversation. And so I think that it would be a good time to segue to what I consider an increasingly disturbing behavior by the man who presides over the Nigerian Senate, Godswill Akpabio, who used to be the governor of Akwa Ibom. This is the man who, having become Senate president, goes around in a convoy that rivals that of the U.S. president. Okay. This is a man who told the members of his chamber that some envelope had been put in their cubicles, as it were, you know, for them to celebrate. I believe it was, some vacation, right? So some millions of naira. This is also a man who recently went to the burial of Herbert Nwigwe, the former chief executive of Access Bank, and his wife, who died tragically in a helicopter crash in the U.S. And he went there, and the governor of Rivers State had spoken in a very moving and fitting way about death, the deceased, and speaking about the fact that people kill and fight for power, and yet that in a sense, if we understood life and what it meant, that it should tame our behavior. And the Senate president got up and in a very tone-deaf response told the governor, "Well, if you're not interested in power, then resign," you know. So it's a way of saying that he, the Senate president, believes in killing for power, in stealing it, in doing whatever it takes to achieve the end of power. But more consequentially, because you can see this as sort of peccadillos, you know, sort of petty deformation of character. But when the Senate president is accused pointedly of padding the Nigerian budget at a time when Nigerians are hit by the worst economic climate in the country's history, and this man is padding the budget, and the monies have been hundreds of millions are handed out to individual members of the Senate and ultimately to individual members of the House of Representatives. And Senator Abdul Ningi of Bauchi sort of exposes this ridiculous, absurd development in an interview. And Godswill Akpabio then presides over the humiliation of this man for, as it were, letting the secret out, and has Senator Ningi suspended for 3 months, you know. When all of this happened, what strikes me is that we have a leadership in Nigeria And of course, you can't use the same the word leader and Nigerian leaders, Nigerian politicians, office holders in the same sentence, in justice. But those who occupy political posts in Nigeria, whether they are appointed or quote unquote elected, are so alienated from the lives of those that they manage that it's unbelievable. It's almost hard to fathom that this is true, right? How do you have a country where the minimum wage, you have to save now more than 3 months of your entire monthly salary, more than 3 months to buy one bag of rice in Nigeria, and senators are being handed 500 million naira, 250 million, billions of naira, perhaps, in the case of the president of the Senate himself, in the name of constituency allowance. And I think that that's really something that is an assault on Nigerians beyond the daily assault of being a Nigerian. I don't know what your take is.
Yeah, well, I'm off this train. I've been off this train for decades of feeling like people are singularly bad when it comes to Nigeria, especially. Politicians are singularly bad. I don't think they are singularly bad. I think some people's awfulness is at the top of the pile. I think the current guy that sits in Aso Rock, his awfulness is at the top of the pile. His awfulness to humanity and human beings in Nigeria as a whole, as a collective, is on top of the pile. But none of them is from a vacuum. All the time I used to complain about the leaders. I always tell that story. I used to, Charlie, when it was Obasanjo, compared those standards, I'm this guy who, obviously I've been privileged enough to see certain things to some, comparatively in terms of Europe, America, all those kind of things, and I'd complain about Obasanjo. Look at the American standard. Even though at that point in time, later on and during that point in time, George Bush, all things that go up must come down. George Bush appears on the scene and Tony Blair and do what they do with the Iraq War. Well, I complained so much that my cousin wanted to pull me and look to my took one look. I said, "Look, cousin is much older than me," and it's like they said, "Look, if people get the leader they deserve, get the people they deserve. If you look at most of these people, they mirror their societies. There are exceptions to the rule, but they largely mirror a lot of things about their societies. They in America, they might confuse you with labels of left and right or whatever, center, centrist, or whatever. But largely, for the most part, not all the time, but for the most part, people get the leaders they deserve. Bless you. Mm-hmm. People get the leaders they deserve. So I was listening to Dele Momodo was talking about, I've gotten this Brazilian book, not this thing, but the book references Asian philosophy, really. I think it's Agnomen, I think. Anyway, don't quote me on the exact distance, but it does talk. The main thing is not Dunning-Kruger effect. When people aspire to be their oppressors, in modern parlance, they'll say hurt people, hurt people. When you're hurt and you don't deal with your hurt, you hurt people. People aspire to be your oppressors, people that are oppressing you. If you walk onto the field in Nigeria today and you pick somebody from the field, chances are they will emulate what you are seeing.
Yes.
Most of these people you see in, that's just a fact. Most of the people you see in government are people who used to stand on the streets and complain. Right? I remember coming across Agbabio multiple times as an example. My mother used to be a solid, I think she still is, a solid member of the Nigerian Bar Association. I remember coming across the guy. There are very few people in Nigerian law that I ever felt were actually intellectually sound anyway, but so it's not, there was nothing spectacular about Agbabio. I remember coming across him when he was also running for governor. And it was intuitive that there's something I laughed at then. I wasn't paying because I had a lot of things going on in my life throughout his tenure. I never paid attention. I had come to condition myself to, I'd come to accept the reality of Nigeria at that time. Agbabio was hailed, in case you've forgotten. If you go back in the media and open those pages, Agbabio was hailed as a great governor. Did he do some things in Akwa Ibom?
Yeah.
Yes, he did some things in Akwa Ibom. Stadium, roads. He was hailed by people seeing those things as a great governor. But Agbabio was an actual, was for everything he did, he took like 7-10 times money away. Agbabio was that bad. And when I say taking, I think even down to like paying salaries, he didn't care. He loves grandioso. That's one thing. That's his own, every criminal has their own modus operandi, right? Agbabio's modus operandi is he likes grand things.
Yes,
40 car convoy. He wants to celebrate his birthday. It's a stadium.
Yeah.
He hears something about, it's like, yeah, you two don't hustle. He's that guy. He loves grand distance, you know. He almost actually he fits the stereotype of an Ibibio guy, actually. Sadly, I don't think FYI, I don't have any fact that the stereotype is right. But the typical, because I did spend a part of my time growing up in Calabar, which is more of an epic place, actually an epic place, right? Spent time in Calabar, all those places where my stomping ground, Odukbani, so many places. I can name a whole bunch of places. So the stereotype would be that Akwa Ibom Ibibios specifically like grand things. They like grandioseness. You know, they just typical again. It's a fact. It's a fact.
Just grandly making up words as you go.
it's just the reality. He likes you know, every small thing. It's kind of a typical Akwa Ibom person. If you give him a pen, he wants a party with the pen, right? It's very different from the stereotype. Again, I don't think the stereotypes are right or generally accurate, but they are there though. And a lot of times you see it. It's different from the stereotype of Yorubas and party. Yorubas like to celebrate. Small thing Friday, thank God it's Friday, let's go celebrate. It's quite different. Because for the most part, Yorubas do like to celebrate something that you could see, you know, you might say you don't want to celebrate a birthday or a birth of a child or something, but Yorubas like that. You could see some of those things as legitimate celebrations. Akwa Ibomites, as well, or Ibibios, are supposed to be people who just like big manism. Doesn't matter what it is. Again, I don't know. It feels, I'm saying all this not to say I know about it or it's bad. I'm saying this to say that sometimes some people create such bad stereotypes. And sometimes I think it's even single-handedly.
Yeah.
Some people create this because Agbabio is kind of the grandioso guy of the Nigerian, of this era of Nigerian politicians. He loves these things. And sadly, you know, if he feels like that kind of person, that it's like Hush Puppy, right? You see Hush Puppy, you see what he does, and I'm impressed. Like, I'm like, man, this guy is impressive, right? Hush Puppy single-handedly perpetuates the stereotype of the Nigerian criminal, of the average Nigerian being a criminal. Now, are most Nigerian criminals, no, are you a criminal? Am I a cop? Do I go about committing breaking the law? No. But will I deny that Hush Puppy continues with that? No, I will not deny it. I'm even impressed that sometimes I bring it up to my friends, like, well, you know, when Nigerians do it, this is the way they do it. Right? So it's not to say, but you feel like, oh, you know, no. It's just to say, like, sometimes those stereotypes belong to just some people. But it now starts feeling like this thing. So Akpabio is a stereotype of a Nigerian politician more than any other thing, more than even any of the stupid tropes I've heard about. But he's a stereotype. But he's not unusual. Most of these guys are like that. They have their perks and quirks. When they get drunk with power, I think it ended up with, you know, the Abacha era and women, followed by the Obasanjo era and women, followed by the Yar'Adua era and clinging to power, followed by the Jonathan era and chaos, followed by the Buhari era and, I mean, nepotism doesn't even do it justice, right? And followed by the Tinubu era and Emi Loko. It is all about me. Akpabio typifies it is all about him at all points in time. But he's not unique. I'm not going to sit down and tell you that Akpabio is some unique figure. And people accept it. People love it. People want to be it. People want to. In fact, I saw a guy saying something that I would, in fact, generally, let me re-echo that advice to anybody listening. That a lot of you that go online abusing these guys, is like, please don't. That these people, they remember and they keep all these things. And it is true. They are petty. They like being hailed. They love their grandioseness. If you have anything to do with them, just like a lady that actually supported Peter Obi as is her right on Twitter, and they put out for a job, and it became a problem with them because Tinubu and co. have said nobody would work for the government that supported any other party. So the guy said, which I echo, if you ever want to go to that, these places, it doesn't matter who is in power, you need to watch the way you talk. Somebody like me, I don't care, because I do not foresee ever in my future. So if you hear me talking the way I talk, because I quite frankly do not care. I don't have anything to care about with all these people. So when people do these things, my advice to you is follow that advice. If you ever want to be like your captors, like your oppressors, like your destroyers, you need to watch the way you talk. The way you
just come back to haunt you.
Yes. Yeah. Just know that me personally, I've got nothing to do. I've got zero to do with any of these people.
No, I think it's a very important point you make, that in the end, it is easy to focus on Tinubu and his particular malfeasance, or Akpabio and the ways in which he shocks our sensibilities in circumstances where the country is going to the toilet, as it were, being flushed to the toilet, and yet you find this insistence on grand gestures, on self-aggrandizement, on the part of a man who is never credited with one single significant idea for ameliorating the social conditions, the suffering of Nigerians. But, you know, he wants to pose as if he's a leader, as if he's a person of consequence, where consequence counts, which is in your impact on society, rather than sort of fitting into the mode of the writer John Bucane, who said in a book years ago that the black man would always be behind the white man because of the black man lives for his gut, for his stomach alone, you know. So our leaders think that leadership is about what you can put away, what you can acquire, sort of this primitive accumulation that they all engage in. And they don't know that at the end of the day, they look ridiculous to the rest of the world. You know, I remember a friend telling me, I don't have firsthand confirmation, but sort of that the late Ken Saro said words like that the world was becoming a global village, and that that the Africans were in danger of being categorized as village idiots, you know. And this proclivity, this tendency to stage spectacles, you know, to buy Rolls Royces and other extremely expensive cars in a country where there are no roads, you know, without feeling a sense of shame, without recognizing the irony that those who build Rolls Royces in their mind assume a certain kind of road, highways that are well paved, that are smooth. They don't expect that you would take their vehicle and, you know, sort of dig into a pothole and dig out and enter another one, and the, you know, the bottom of it will crash against the asphalt and rocks of the road and so on and so forth. So we have leaders who have no shame, you know, who build very grand mansions in their villages, surrounded by an eyesore of rust and of poverty and of decay. And they don't feel it. They think that, oh, I've built a house. In fact, they seem to like everybody else to appear impoverished because they think they stand out. But when you are the only person who has this grand project in surrounded by surrounded by poverty, you yourself actually project yourself as the poorest of the poor, the poverty of the mind, which is what is at play here. But, you know, your point is actually quite opposite, that ultimately it's a systemic structural thing, you know. For example, a lot of people wanted Peter Obi to be president because they expected that there'll be a change in the country. And one question that continues to hit me is that, where are those legislators who got elected as on the platform of the Labour Party? Are they standing up in the National Assembly to say to the Nigerian people, are they the ones, are they taking any or demonstrating any different ethos in governance? No. I think that they are in on the take, right? They're quietly eating, and as it were, it's as if they're saying, we're too busy eating to use the same mouth to protest that things are not going well for the vast majority of Nigerians. And, you know, so the other issue that I wanted to touch on briefly, and before I yield the place to you, is, it's nothing new, but something that strikes me as a spike in violence, okay? The abduction, renewed abduction of kids in schools in Kaduna State and elsewhere. And the fact that bandits will show up in a school, abduct 200 and something kids. Where does that happen? I mean, if you look at it, 200 kids, that's a lot of kids to take away. How does the planning take place and the execution of that plan takes place without any agency of the government, without any law enforcement agency, any security agency being tipped off or doing something about it? How do people take 200 kids and drive them through the roads and then take them into the bush? And the Nigerian state seems helpless. And it speaks to what we all have known for years and years and years. The Nigerian state is essentially abject and failed, that it does not exist. And then you see what happened in Delta State, where some soldiers were killed and decapitated as they moved in into an area of intercommunal clashes, you know. And on the one hand, it's shocking what happened. But we also know that in the past, in fact, not just in the past, that Nigerian institutions, the police, the military, can be hired, can be rented by wealthy individuals to fight on their behalf. So who knows whether the soldiers had lent themselves to fight on one side, so the other side saw them as fair game and then killed them. And, you know, so all of this keeps me quasi awake at night. Not because of that there's any novelty to them, because we've seen all of this, and we saw Zango Kataf years ago during Obasanjo. We saw the Odi massacres, you know, where some policemen were killed, and, you know, the police and the military moved in and basically massacred every moving, living thing in those communities. But the fact that they keep reproducing themselves, it's just horrific.
There's something I always hear about this. I mean, first thing is like, as we this thing, because I gotta go. So, but something I always hear about this, Peter Obi and Labour Party, people have all these arguments, and I always start from, well, depends on the conversation, but when this thing comes up, I thought, look, man, it's the same thing I just said. The field, the pipeline. If you go out there and pick out 10 people that want to be politicians, they will give you the same effect. Yes, they like the yes. It is what it is. But when people try to conflate what the Peter Obi movement is supposed to be with the legislatures there, the people that got into office under the Labour Party. I think it's kind of I've heard that too many times. It's always kind of like, man, that's it's to some degree it's just like, no, you have to put things in their perspective. What did the Peter Obi movement mean? A lot of the people that were Peter Obi, a lot of the people that were in the movement were kind of part of Labour Party to some degree, quasi Labour people. A lot of them were not too. And some of the people that got in, so what did they get in from? What positions did they hold? What effect could they have in those positions that they held or they held? Can a fresh senator do what Ngi did? And why did Ngi do what he did? You know, I don't see all this kind of distance. And okay, in positions where you have as a governor, you're a chief executive, you actually have executive power, meaning you actually have people working for you that affect changes. Labour have one governorship, which is the next thing to being the president is the emperor. The governors are the lords. The governor is literally, I mean, I wish it was a joke, really. These things are, I mean, if you read the constitution, an example is that all land in the state belongs to the governor. Governor can take your land tomorrow and you'd be like, yeah. So, and in the one state they have, people have reported that the one state they have is functioning fantastic. They've done this, they've done that. They've done a lot of populist things. They've cut those nonsensical pensions to ex-governors that they give them like 10 houses every two seconds or whatever they used to have, right? So, when people say that, I'm like, okay, you have to differentiate what they can do. You have to, it's not enough to just be like, oh, which people, which positions, what could they do that they are not doing? Or is it that you expect them to be in power, to be in office rather, and you want them to protest on the streets? Is it that, what does the Peter Obi movement really typify? It really typifies a guy that is saying, hey, I'm going to cut down government waste. I'm going to engage people in having a conversation on how Nigeria should move forward. And I'm going to include, you know, and that to be inclusive to everybody, right? That essentially is what Peter Obi is talking about. Well, I have a track record. I am not a politician. Dilip Modi was saying the same thing. I was listening to this thing this morning. He's not a politician. He comes out to contest. He goes back to his business. Peter Obi is back to his business, right? So I would love to have seen people, when people talk about those things, talk about it more in depth. It's always like, I don't even believe in this. And I don't need to keep stating this reality. I think the system needs to be changed, which is one reason why I felt like Peter would be a better situation to try and address that system. Try is the key word. I did not say that was going to be the case, right? But, you know, and then there's a continuation, obviously, the kidnappings and stuff like that. To me, I just, par for the course. What's going to happen? Hungry people are going to look for ways to make money. If you have a cousin that is outside the country and you guys can come in and kidnap, great for you. If you're going to the country now, people tell you, don't tell people when you're even coming because they could take you. I was having that conversation yesterday. I was like, could they even put off burying my aunt this Friday till maybe even next week? And you know, they have to bury her in the monastery. And it's like, look, there'll be security concerns once she starts announcing burials. If people will lay wait. That's how my brother-in-law got kidnapped. People are getting more and more desperate. People will do anything. So if you have a whole bunch of grown-ass men and women that have nothing to do, walking up and down hungry, and a lot of them have access to weapons, going to kidnap a whole school is easy. It's easy for the kids, not fantastic. You should even be happy that they've gone into prisons, houses, kidnap whole families. So kidnapping a whole school at this point is like, oh, okay, cool. You know, this is not bring back our girls era. This is not where, when it went to that level, it shocked people. There's only so much you can shock human beings. If I give you a taser, the first time it hits your body, it's going to shock you. The rest of it is just moving you up and down, passing the voltage. It's no longer shocking you, passing the voltage up and down. That's why you see sometimes they throw a taser at somebody, right? And the person, you'll shock the person, you'll see the person will go and carry the cop and beat up the cop or something, right? Because the shock is no longer there. Yeah. You know, and the voltage that is being passed through can't stop that person in particular, specific, right? So it's sad. And I say all this to say life waits for nobody, right? It keeps moving, it keeps progressing. If you set things in A direction or you set things in B direction, is going to go with in that direction. Nigeria is set in A direction, which has been going for a long time, and it's going to keep going there. So it's going to keep going in a way that makes logical sense. And what makes logical sense in Nigeria is kidnappings, killings, people just dropping dead due to economic hardships, almost quite likely. I can't say for certain, but quite likely. And it's tough man, it's crazy. And you just have what you have. You have politicians like Akpabio that I didn't even want to pick on Akpabio. I just think Akpabio is just a funny. And FYI man, I think I still have my family still has property in Calabar and Akwa Ibom. So my father spoke Efik and Ibibio growing up, so I see that as my second home. So it's the same kind of I still grew up in all those places, man. I did them in Song, Marion Road, Calabar South, Orok, all those places, man. It's my second home, man. So and you know, we have a long history, the Igbos and the Bibios as well, historically. So it's very interesting to see. But it doesn't matter, man. I can pick up anybody. I can pick up Chimaroke in Enugu State. I can give you some tropes about Chimaroke that he seems to, you know. Anyway, it's all just par for the course. You're going to have these characters come out, and it's kind of like somebody said, "Would you have wanted Jesse Jackson to be president of America?" And somebody said, "No." That they were only voting for him to protest. They said, "Why are you voting? Just to protest." They said, but why? They said, "Man, that guy, you know, they don't even know how many kids he has." he has, like we're talking about these black politicians, like, it seems to be a lot of them that are just like comical in this era, right? There are so many of them, but that is not who Nigerians can be. You can see who we can be when we move out of the country. And I know it's just the system is designed in a way that even when you pick somebody from this system, it's going to have that outcome. But you see us. Yeah, you see us where we are. People do great things. There are a lot of great people from this thing. In fact, is the worst of them that end up either. Okay. Yeah, is the worst of them that end up is the worst of us. That from Nigeria end up defining us. I guess America, like for instance, we live in America. America is great to propaganda. I was listening to Candace Owens' interview to this morning on the Breakfast Club, and she was telling them, which they didn't know, which I know because I actually worked partially with that department. Well, not I actually worked with that department. The U.S. Defense Department has a budget for entertainment. they actually co-produce a lot of these movies, Top Gun, Terminator, or they don't want any images of America that looks bad, you know. But we are the contrary. We want the worst images that we can have to represent us. It's crazy. Like that, it's like we have a budget. The American government, which I've working with the U.S. military, right? They have a budget which all these movies hand in hand. The Chinese do the same thing. Chinese are big in Hollywood. They want the best of their country put forward. Doesn't even matter what it is. Even when you have American serial killers, America wants the serial killers to make America still look good. You know, they're not trying to make their country look bad. You know, we just go about, you know, just offering the worst that we can find of Nigeria. And it's terrible of Nigeria, of our towns, of our villages, of our ethnic groups, and we line up behind them. And then when, you know, it looks terrible, man. It's just, but it's comical though. It makes a good comedy. What can I say? You know, anyway, that being said.
Well, so that's, I know it's a short one, but that's the kind of day that today is. You're very busy. I'm quasi busy. And it's such a delight to, again, have you all, our listeners, join us on this episode. And we look forward to having you back in a few days. Thank you very much. And have a brilliant, brilliant rest of the week.
All right.